All right. Hall of Fame for today is the Nitziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Okay, he's not from Berlin. That's his last name. He was born 1816. He died in 1893, and he lived almost entire life in Russia, which is why it's really weird when we go on the Poland trip. We see his cover in Poland. It's like he just got ill towards the end of his life, and he went to Warsaw for like some treatment. He died there, and the people in Warsaw wouldn't let, you know, wouldn't let him be buried back in Russia where he's from. It's a little tug of war with, you know, a dead body. It's a little bit weird. But anyway, his kever is in Poland. He lived his whole life in Russia. Now, he writes many svarim. He becomes Rashiva, the greatest yeshiva of his generation that becomes the prototype for all yeshivas today. The famous yeshiva of Elazhin. He was Rashiva for nearly the last 40 years. And this was during the heyday. This was during the last 40 years was when it was like really booming. And all these great people came from this yeshiva. And it almost never happened. He writes in the first sefer that he wrote, Emek She'ela, commentary on the Shiltos, he writes an introduction and he says that he luckily overheard a conversation between his tutor and his parents. See, we often think that everyone learned in yeshiva all the time and they learned for, you know, Yomim V'Layla since they were like 4 years old. But it's not true. And people learned, let's say, about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, cheder, and that was it. Now, parents that cared, they hired a tutor afterwards to teach their kids. So the parents of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda hired a tutor. I don't know how old he was, maybe 7, 8, whatever it was. And he overhears the tutor comes to this house. He's in his bedroom. And the tutor says to the family, you know what? I really feel they're taking your money. He just doesn't care. He's not motivated. Doesn't really care so much about learning. I think that your time would be better spent if you taught him a trade. Let him go apprentice by a tailor, by a shoemaker, a cobbler, something, so he can make a good, honest living. But Torah is not his thing. And when the tutor leaves, he comes out of the room crying, saying to his parents, no, please give me another chance. I promise I'll try harder. And because of that, he ends up eventually writing this Emek She'ela. And he said, what would have happened? Had I not overheard this conversation, my parents would have just stopped sending me to the tutor. I would have had no idea why. And I would have died after 120 years being a good, honest cobbler, a shoemaker, in Russia, probably would have learned, you know, Shnayim Mikra Vecha Targum, you know, maybe would have learned even a little bit more, obviously been didactic and mitzvot and daven with a minyan 3 times a day. I get up to Shemayim, expecting Kadosh Baruch Hu to say, good job. And he would have said to me, where's the Emek She'ela? And I would have said, the what? He goes, you know, your commentary on the Shiltot. I would have said, the what? What's the Shiltot? He goes, you were supposed to write a commentary on the Shiltot. I never would have known it. I said, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Okay. Now, he gets into the learning, you know, gets into it because he was not learning well at 8. He gets into it at 8. Okay. And he's already now in Volozhin, learning in Volozhin. And at the age of 13, the Rosh Yeshiva handpicks him to be his son-in-law, to marry his second daughter. Okay? So clearly he showed some promise. Okay, by the age of 13, I guess he had a slump at the age of 8, but by 13, he was doing very well. I'll get to it right now. The Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Chaim Volozhin's son, Rav Yitzchak Volozhin, known as Rav Itzala Volozhin. Okay? And he handpicks him. Age 13, he gets married. By the age of 30, he's giving shir in Volozhin. By the age of 37, he's the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. And he's Rosh Yeshiva there for the last, like, about 40 years of the yeshiva. Some of the illustrious students that he had, names that might be familiar to you. Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook. Okay? Rav Israel Zalman Meltzer. So Rav Israel Meltzer, the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler. He started the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Rav Shimon Shkop. I don't know if, recording, you mentioned sometimes Rav Shimon Shkop. So he wrote the Shari Yosha. Rav Moshe Epstein, Levush Mordechai, who was also the Rashi Mitzlabatka. Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, who was not only his nephew, but he was the author of at least the Torah Tzemimah that you've heard of and other Sfarim as well. Okay, these were some of the names that you might have familiar with, and there's so many more. He married, you know, we said the Rosh Hashiva's daughter, Reina Batya. She was his first wife, and he had with her his oldest son, Chaim. He goes on to become, you've probably heard of Rav Chaim Berlin, the yeshiva named after him in New York, Rav Chaim Berlin. Now, many years later, she dies, and his nephew, Baruch HaLevi Epstein, who learned in Volozhin by his uncle from 1873 to 1878, so he's obviously not just a yeshiva student, he's like a ben bayit in the house, very close with his uncle, he makes a shidduch. The Nitziv's wife passed away, and he wants to fix up his sister with the Nitziv. Okay? There's a huge age discrepancy, but he knows his sister really wants to marry a huge Talmid Chacham. They already, someone tried to fix her up with some guy, and she didn't think he was a big enough Talmid Chacham. And she viewed it as a privilege to marry the Nitziv in his old age and to take care of the Rashiva Balazhin. She thought it was a big deal. It took some convincing to convince his father, the Aruch HaShulchan, to let his daughter marry his brother-in-law. That wasn't so simple. But finally he did, and they were married. And the Nitziv then has a second son with his second wife. Her name is Batya Miriam. Okay? When he has the second son, he's now 64 years old. There's a 48-year difference between the two brothers. 48 years. Okay? The Nitziv only lives to 77, so it means that basically, you know, when his son Mayor Berlin, later changed, Hebraicized to Mayor Bar Ilan, okay, big Zionist, religious Zionist leader, from Mayor Bar Ilan, he makes it to his bar mitzvah, and then afterwards his father passed away, because after all, he was quite old when he fathered him. Okay, so 48 years difference between the two sons. Now, the Nitziv was an innovator. He said, the way that we learn Shas is, it's missing stuff. When we learn Shas, how come we're ignoring the Gaonic literature? People are only looking at Rishonim. He felt we should look at the Gaonim. He felt that we should look at the Midrashei Halacha. We should look at the Mechilta, the Sifra, the Sifri. And the Nitziv himself wrote, as I said, he wrote commentaries on Gaonic literature, on the She'ultot. He wrote commentaries on the Mechilta, the Sifra. He felt that this was very important to our learning of Shas. He also stressed the importance of learning Tanakh. Most people did not learn Tanakh at this point because who did? The Maskilim. Those Jews who were involved in the Enlightenment, they felt Tanakh was very important to learn. So if they felt it was important to learn, obviously it became treif puzzle for everyone in Yeshiva. Then it said, this is ridiculous, the Tanakh, how come no one's learning Tanakh? So he began morning Seder every day, giving a Parsha Shir. That Parsha Shir turned into his commentary, Emek Davar, on Chumash. Later on, he added addendums, that's the Har Chabat Davar, but this is the Emek Davar, began as a Parsha Shir to his students. He felt it's important to learn Tanakh, A, to understand Halachot and the stories, and B, to derive wisdom and morality from lessons that we can learn from the stories. Now, we'll come back to Emek Davar later, just a little bit about the Nitziv. As I said, he was an extremely hard worker. Okay, how do we know he's a hard worker? So we have literature that when the Nitziv got married, his wife, Reina Batya, Rosh Hashiva's daughter, she knew a little bit about learning, right? She's around Torah her whole life. She was jealous that her older sister got to marry a real Talmid Chacham. Her older sister married Eliezer Fried. Now that guy, he knew how to learn. And I got stuck with Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, you know? Now, most of you never heard of Eliezer Fried. So the Nitziv pushed himself. Maybe it's possible that he didn't have as great a head, but he pushed himself. He had tremendous hasmada. And there's stories about it, how crazy was his hasmada. Not just that he learned during the break. You know, that's for us, that's hasmada. He kept his feet in cold water so that he wouldn't fall asleep. He would take a little nap. He didn't have an alarm on his phone. So he wanted to take a little power nap. What did he do? He took one of those little birthday candles, lit it between his fingers, put his head down. After a couple of minutes, it burnt down, woke him up. Okay, continue. That was his power nap. But now he denies all the stories. But as we know, if they're telling those stories about him, there's probably something there, right? If it was a birthday candle, it was a cold, I don't know. But there's something there, right? Hanukkah candles, yeah. It's a 45-minute Hanukkah candle. Okay. There is a story that the Netziv, in the middle of the night, he'd been discussing a sugya with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was a Rebbe in the yeshiva, and he sent a student, go get Rav Chaim. I thought of something about what we were discussing. Rav Chaim showed up, he apologized and said, I'm sorry, it took me so long. I had to get dressed. So, I had no idea you'd be sleeping already at this hour, whatever that hour was. I'm sure it wasn't 9:30 in the night. For that Netziv, let's go, oh, my bad, I never would have woken you up. Okay. He was so dedicated to the yeshiva that when his home burned down, so this is the thing, those of you in Poland, so you know there's so many forests, so too in Russia. Basically, everything's made out of wood. So if you look up, the Great Fire of, you can basically find so many different ones depending on the year. This is the Great Fire of 1886, because one house is made out of wood and it catches fire, and if the wind's strong enough, the whole town goes down. So his home gets burned to a crisp, and he moves into the yeshiva. He's got a little apartment underneath the Beis Medrash. People said to him, how could you sleep here? Volozhin had round-the-clock learning. Right? Why? Because there's a Midrash that says, if there isn't some learning going on in the world, so then, the world's going to cease to exist. So narrowly we say, no problem. When I'm sleeping, they're learning in Australia, New York. We got it covered with the time zones. But the Netziv felt, let's not rely on anybody. And they had shifts, right? It was like soldiers. You have the night shift. People had shifts and they were learning all the time. He took the hardest shifts. Well, the hardest shifts, right after Yom Kippur. Everyone files down to eat. He stayed in the base, continued learning. So the first Chavrusa got back up after they were eating. But we can't leave the base empty. So there was nonstop learning. So they said, how could you sleep? There's always noise. He goes, you don't get it. I'm like a miller who all the while that he hears the windmill churning, he feels good. He goes, I can sleep like a baby. As if the windmill would stop, the silence would wake me up. So too, as long as I hear learning, life is good. If it would be quiet, I wake up in a second. Right? So this was the Netziv moving in. Now, I don't know how much of a family he had at this time. He was older, probably just his wife. Now, he was a genuinely happy person. And once a friend, I have a feeling I know who it is, but I don't want to say, a friend said to him, it was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, he goes, may we be zoche to enjoy the Korban Pesach together this year. To which Netziv said, Chas v'shalom, I never want to have the Korban Pesach with you. He said, why? He said, you're so full of anxieties. He goes, hey, what are you... You're anxious that, oh no, maybe the matzah really wasn't totally shmura. Maybe some chametz got into the food that we're eating. Maybe some, machal Shabbos touched the wine, and now the wine's not, eligible for use. And then when you bring the Korban Pesach, you probably go, oh my gosh, I probably had the wrong kavanah, messed the whole thing up. Me, I'd be happy that I have the privilege to eat matzah shmura mekayim the mitzvah. And if I have the opportunity to actually bring the Korban Pesach, I'll be so overjoyed. Why would I want to ruin my simcha with your anxieties? Okay? The Torah Tamima writes in his memoirs, Makor Baruch, that... here's the story. Rav Baruch Levi Epstein wrote his memoirs. It was around World War I. Life was difficult. And he was like nostalgic. The good old days. And he was writing about the good old days. And a lot of it, talks about these famous rabbis that he came in contact with. After all, his father was the Aruch HaShulchan. His uncle's in Netziv. He came in contact with, all the big guns of the generation. And he's telling stories about his encounters with them. Now, there's a very large book, many volumes. Two parts were translated into English. I think we have them here. The first one's called My Uncle the Netziv. The second one's called Recollections. Okay? Worthwhile reading, very interesting reading. Now, what happened? Lakewood Cheder heard that, I think it was Targum Press, was translating My Uncle the Netziv. I said, this is fantastic. We're going to have, a fundraising dinner. We'll give out a sefer in English, because no one in Lakewood reads Hebrew, in English, about a gadol, by a gadol. I mean, can you get any better? It's about the Netziv written by the Torah Tamima. Fantastic. So they ordered, 500 volumes. before it's even printed, to give it out at their dinner. And then, like a week before the dinner, some guy actually decided to read it. And he said they canceled the order. Canceled the order. Shalavim bought it up at half price, gave it out at their dinner, covered up the liquid cheder thing in the back. Doesn't matter. But yes, this is a true story. Now, what's in the book that's so objectionable? It's crazy. Like, oh, you canceled, but it's written by a gadol about a gadol. Okay, so here's a few ideas. One idea, possibly, is, what does it say? The Netziv once said, you know why the Rambam made mistakes? Huh? Who could say the Rambam made mistakes? You know why the Rambam made mistakes? Because he learned by himself. Look at the Rashba, it's so clear. So why? Because the Rashba learned with a whole chabura of guys. He bounced ideas off of his, chaverim. They said, no, that doesn't make sense. The Rashba, that's why you should learn. The Rambam wrote it by himself, and therefore he made mistakes. Okay, that's controversial. Okay, but that's, I guess, not crazy. You know what's crazy? The Netziv had secular books in his library. Can you imagine giving that in Lakewood? The Netziv had secular books in his library. Okay, and this is really nuts. The Netziv read the newspaper every Shabbos. It was his own Nick Shabbos. Not just, the Frum newspapers. He read the Maskilim, what the Maskilim were writing. And at the Shabbos table, he shared current events with everyone at the table. He said, you guys probably aren't up on this. Let me fill you in on what's going on in the world. Okay. Now, his desire to be knowledgeable about world events led to him becoming a world, leader for Jews all over the place, fielding questions from all over the world in halacha and public policy. Some of these letters are found in his two-volume, Meshiv Davar, right? For example, in Germany and in Hungary, so there was this movement called Ausstreet, right? That they didn't want to have, in every parliament, there was like a Jewish party. They didn't want to be together as Jews. So the Orthodox Jews wanted to have their own separate party. We're going to have our own separate party. And he felt this was terrible. And he said, quote, such advice is as painful as a dagger in the body of the nation. Because he said, all Jews are one nation. Why are we splitting it up? He joins the pre-Herzl Chibat Zion movement, this Lovers of Zion movement, and wrote letters urging Jews to join and support Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, even though the people that are running this are Chilonim. But he adds, the goal isn't just rebuilding Arzeinu HaKadosh, it's to live there al pi Torah v'mitzvot. And therefore, towards that end, he pushed religious leaders, get involved. Let's get involved and try to shape what the state is going to look like. When Baron Rothschild started the first winery in, millennium, In Israel, the Carmel Winery, he sent a bottle to the Netziv, sent a bottle of wine to the Netziv. When the Netziv got it, he put on his big day Shabbos before he would drink from this wine. This is wine from Eretz Yisrael. This is very chashuv. Now, since most of his life is spent in the Volozhin Yeshiva, basically from pre-bar mitzvah till, the day he dies almost. So, a little background on Volozhin. Volozhin Yeshiva was started in 1803 by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, Talmud Muvak of the Vilna Gaon, who was basically the Vilna Gaon pushed for this. It took a while, several years, till he actually got it started after the Graz passing. But the idea was to stress Iyun HaYashar. Felt that there was too much pilpul that was going on, that was driving people away. People were getting turned off from learning. And now the approach is going to be Iyun HaYashar, learning straight, understanding what's going on. Now, what's interesting is Rav Chaim was different than his Rebbe. The Vilna Gaon, who we spoke about before, he made a cherem against the Hasidim. Rav Chaim Volozhin had Hasidim as students in the yeshiva, opened the yeshiva doors to them. He continued the battle of the Vilna Gaon, but on an intellectual level, he wrote the Nefesh HaChaim, trying to prove the importance of Talmud Torah, that you don't need to have some other spiritual ecstasy component. We do mitzvahs because we do mitzvot. The Nefesh HaChaim, a straightforward Lichtvak, misnagish approach. That's how we'll fight his battle. But to say Hasidim can't come, no, of course, let them come to the yeshiva. He opens yeshiva in 1803, and he's the Rosh Yeshiva until 1821 when he passes away. During this time, the yeshiva grows from a student body of 10 to about 100. That was different than all the other yeshivas of its day. Other yeshivas of its day, people would go to, let's say, the larger city where the greater Rav was, you know, had his shteller, and they would dorm at people's homes and have meals at people's homes and just learn the base medrash. Here, he wanted this to be a world yeshiva. He collected money from all over the world, and people came and they had the dormitories and meals and became the prototype for all the yeshivas that we know today. After his death, they renamed the yeshiva after him and was called Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim after Reb Chaim of Elazhin. Now his son takes over. Said Reb Yitzhak, Reb Itzel of Elazhin, he takes over, and during his time, till 1849 when he passed away, the yeshiva grows to about 200 students. 200 students in learning in the yeshiva. In 1849, he chooses his oldest son-in-law. Okay, his oldest son-in-law, Eliezer Fried, we mentioned before, he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Netziv, second son-in-law, he becomes the assistant Rosh Yeshiva. But Eliezer Fried died young, 1853, he's dead. And now what happens is we have co-Rosh Yeshiva, the Netziv and Rav Yosef Dov, or known as Rav Yasha Ber Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik from YU's great-grandfather, who he's named after, Rav Chaim's father. Rav Yasha Ber Soloveitchik and the Netziv both are descendants of Rav Chaim Volozhin. The Netziv married his granddaughter, and Rav Yasha Ber Soloveitchik is a great-grandson of Rav Chaim Volozhin. Okay? Both of them have the Yichus, and they're the co-Rashi Yeshiva. But then all hell broke loose. Right? Because think about who's your student body. You got like these teenagers who when you're a teenager, you feel you know everything. So those students of Reb Chaim felt, no one knows how to learn like Reb Chaim. He should be the Rosh Yeshiva. And those students of the Netziv said, obviously the Netziv should be Rosh Yeshiva. And they start trash talk. They're ripping on at each other opposing Rosh Yeshiva and the Purim Spiels. They're throwing water balloons out the window. They're taking away Sfarim she can't give shir. It's crazy, the memory of literature, what's going on. It's nuts. Okay? And therefore, they call in a beis din of Gedolei Ador to come in and decide who's going to be Rosh Yeshiva. Because this co-Rosh Yeshiva thing just wasn't working out. One of the rabbis, who was the Maggid of Vilna, explained to somebody, he goes, here's my dilemma. He goes, I'm Maggid. I go around, I speak on Parsha Shavua, and this is what I do. Every time I get to a Parsha, I look for the hero, and I look for the villain. And the hero, I build him up, he's the greatest person ever lived. And the villain, oh, worst, no one's ever like him. And then, when do I run into a problem? End of Sefer Bereishis. Who's the villain with Yosef Ve'echav? I'm like, oh, someone's a villain? He goes, that's how I feel here. I have to say one of these two illustrious people shouldn't be Rosh Yeshiva. He goes, that's my dilemma. In the end, the based in Paskin, Netziv. Netziv's the Rosh Yeshiva. For Yasha Beres is his assistant. Okay? And he remains as his assistant until 1865. At that point, he leaves. He goes to Brisk. But just so you should know, it's like the families are still okay. The Netziv's granddaughter ends up marrying Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Right? So there's intermarriage there between the families. And in 1881, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik actually becomes the Netziv's assistant. So first it was his father, and then Reb Chaim became his assistant. Now, towards the end, due to old age and fatigue, the Netziv wants to retire and move to Eretz Israel. As we said, it's a member of Chibat Zion, Chobet Zion, he wants to move to Eretz Israel. And then the Netziv makes an announcement that my son, Chaim Berlin, who at this point wasn't in Volozhin, he was a Rav somewhere else, I'm naming him Rosh Yeshiva. He's going to come back. And what happened? Round two broke out. He said, what do you mean Rav Chaim? We have Rav Chaim Soloveitchik here. What do you mean Rav Chaim Berlin? And it started getting crazy again, to which the Netziv unretired. And said, all right, forget it, I'll stay on. You know, he ended up not making it to Eretz Yisrael. He said, there's too much fighting here. So he stayed on. Now, under the Netziv, the yeshiva grew in the 1870s to about 300 students, in the 1880s to about 400. Although by the end, with so much fighting going on, students started leaving to other yeshivas. At this time, a lot of other famous yeshivas are opening up. Names you might have heard of, Telz, Slabatka, Mir, Radin, Kletsk, Slonim, Lublin, right? So there was an attrition just because people said, all right, enough here, and they started moving to other places. The yeshiva's derech and learning was, we start with brachos, and we go through till nida. There's no such thing as yeshiva shemesechtas. We learn everything. We learn a bein, right? And they would just go through, and they went at probably a much quicker pace than anyone here is. Rav Beryl Wine, I once heard him speaking. He said his father was in Volozhin, actually was like a reincarnation of Volozhin. He goes, in one Chorevzman, they learned Gittin and Kedushin Be'iyun. Right? So they were learning, I don't know, some like Daf Yomi Be'iyun. That's what was going on in Volozhin. Now, during this end of the yeshiva, the first half of the week, the first half of the week, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik would give shir to the whole yeshiva. The second half of the week, the Netziv would, so they got seeing the different styles. Okay. Now, we said the Amik Dabar was originally given in yeshiva, and therefore the target audience are Talmidei Chachamim. So the Musar is sort of directed primarily to them. Although, since the Maskilim were making inroads in learning Tanakh, the Netziv felt it his responsibility to show that the drashot of Chazal are not ridiculous ideas made up, but all the drashot of Chazal, you can see actually, if you learn the psukim well, you'll actually understand where the drashot come from. So this is also one of his goals in his shiurim. That he would say that is the, you know, omek of the pshat. Okay. Some examples of how this parish might have been directed to the students include, as I highly recommend you look at, Introduction to Sefer Bereishis. The Netziv, it's one page, really it's worthwhile looking at it. He talks about how the Avos were Yashar. It doesn't talk about the difference between Yashar and being a Tzaddik, right? Yashar. So what does it mean to be Yashar? So he says what happened was Bayit Sheni was destroyed because people were condescending. Bayit Sheni was destroyed because I looked at you and said, you're not like me. And since you're not like me, you're obviously wrong. Because if you're not like me, how could you be right? And this was his whole idea, that people just looked down upon others because they were different. Now, people say, so what was he trying to say? Could be he was talking about what was going on in his time period, that most religious Jews looking down upon those religious who wanted to be involved in Zionism, possibly. Or maybe it was just locally in the yeshiva. Oh, you're a Talmud in the Tziv. Reb Chaim doesn't know how to learn. We're a Tziv Reb Chaim. You know, whatever it was. But each person felt, I know, and you obviously are wrong. So this is like one of the most famous ideas. He makes veiled references to Chassidut, stressing halacha over kavana. He said, look, Nadav and Avihu, they were filled with passion, but it wasn't the halacha. So it's just wrong. He makes references to, you know, Zmanei Tfila. You know, the importance of that as opposed to, well, I don't have kavana yet. He talks about bias rishon. People at Bamot, they were doing Avodas Hashem, but great, you were trying to do something, but if that's not the halacha, so then it's just wrong. He obviously makes lots of references to the importance of learning. Talmud Torah, he's talking to students. The importance of Mikdushim. He says Chidushim is very important. He goes, the Luchot Shniot are considered more important than the Luchot Rishon because Moshe Rabbeinu, he's the one that carved out the Luchot Shniot. So too, we have to carve out our own chelik in learning, and we have to come up with chidushim. He talks also about how every Jew's got his own tafkid. You don't have to be just like, you know, your father or your Rebbe. Every Jew has his own tafkid. Now, probably the biggest problem with my uncle, the Netziv, is why was Volozhin closed? Okay? There is an idea that's put forward by, you know, Haredi world. Volozhin, it was closed because the Russian government wanted to introduce some secular studies. The Netziv said, not one inch. No secular studies whatsoever. I'd rather close down the yeshiva. And that's the banner cry of, you know, all the Haredi yeshivas. That's what you have in Israel. You know, can't even teach math. Can't even teach, you know, basics, nothing. Okay. My uncle, the Netziv, painted a totally different picture. Now, Rabbi J.J. Schachter was now in YU. He wrote a seminal article, a very long article, copious footnotes, and he says the truth is somewhere in the middle, and I'm going to tell it to you based on basically, you know, what his said, but you should know it's closer to Michael than it's said, and they just say nothing. Okay. It says like this. The Russian government and the Maskilim worked together that Volozhin should introduce Russian language and literature. Some of the Maskilim could be because they wanted to corrupt, you know, the Yeshiva Bachram, and some could be because they felt it was really in their best interest. Whatever the case was, this is what was pushed upon the Netziv. Against his will, the Netziv gave in to the Russian language, but for only about 20% of his students, after hours, in a different building. He handpicked the students, said, okay, these are the students that are about to leave the yeshiva anyway. Probably doesn't hurt for them to be able to speak the vernacular when they go out. And therefore, not in the yeshiva building, but somewhere else, will teach Russian language. And even this, he had to beg them, please go, please go. They don't want to leave the base. You know, please go to these classes. Okay. Now, as an individual, we saw that he had secular books. He even hired a tutor for his son, Meir, to learn Russian. It was well known that people in Volozhin read secular books. But the Netziv was against it in the yeshiva. He was against secular books because it was Bittul Torah. Right? One story that I came across. There was a mashkiach who was walking the Beis Medrash. I guess the Netziv already told people, you know, told his staff what to be out, you know, on the lookout for. And he sees a guy, he's got a sefer. It says, Avat Zion. And he's learning a sefer. The Rosh Yeshiva grabs the sefer, throws it to the floor, then grabs the student, picks up the book, walks to the Rosh Yeshiva's office, throws it down on his desk, and says, this is what he was reading. The Netziv picked it up, kissed it, and explain to the Mashkiach, this is a Sefer. The way you can tell, if it says Aleph, Bet, Gimel, it's a Sefer. If it says 1, 2, 3, it's a book. Now what happened was, there was a romance called Avat Zion. It was set in Israel in the time of Yeshayahu, and the Mashkiach saw Avat Zion. He thought he's reading a romance in the base. Threw it on the floor. He says, no, it's Aleph, Bet, Gimel. This is Yeshivot and Shuvot, Avat Zion. Okay. The Netziv saw his yeshiva as Kulo Torah. And this can be seen from, he outlawed all newspapers and journals in the yeshiva, even though we said he himself read. He weren't even allowed to publish Torah journals, although clandestinely it existed in Volozhin. Two, you couldn't belong to any Zionist societies in the yeshiva. Well, even though we said he himself was a member and he viewed it as a mitzvah. And this also existed clandestinely, but as far as the Netziv was concerned, this is Bittul Torah. He didn't allow Musar into the yeshiva. Okay, the famous story of Itzla Petersberger came to the yeshiva. He wanted to try to introduce Musar. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said to him, look, Musar's like medicine. He says, if you're sick, you need the medicine. Baruch Hashem, we're all healthy here. We don't need your Musar, sir. Okay, here clandestinely as well, Musar was learned in the yeshiva. But if you want to see the most stark case of how the Netziv was Kulo Torah and everything else was Bittul Torah, he didn't allow Tehillim to be said for his very sick wife. Because Tehillim's Bittul Torah. We can be learning now. Why would we be saying Tehillim? If so, Rabbi Schechter wants to say, it's quite clear the Netziv begrudgingly allowed some Russian after hours, not in the main yeshiva building, but outside, to some students. When the government felt that wasn't sufficient and came up with new laws. And what are the new laws? Okay, listen to this. Secular studies must be taught in yeshiva from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Okay, rule number one. Rule number two, no limude kodesh can be after shkia. Now in Russia in the winter, that might basically call off all learning because they're going to get close to shkia at 3 o'clock. Okay, number three, even on days where there's more, you can't learn Torah more than 10 hours a day. And if that wasn't enough, every member of your faculty has to have a yeshiva degree, has a university degree. Okay, not to fire my whole staff. Based on that, it's no wonder that Netziv said, I'm going to close down Volozhin, because using that criteria, he doesn't have a yeshiva anymore. January 22nd, 1892, Volozhin, his doors are closed. In his 70s, the Netziv now travels around to collect money to pay off the yeshiva's debts. And after that, he wants to finally make aliyah. But 18 months later, in 1893, while in Warsaw getting medical treatment, he passes away. Now, I'll end with this last thing. I get chills every time I say it. I think it's such a cool thing. At his funeral, Rav Chaim Berlin, his son, eulogized him. And he said, Gemara tells us that when the Beis HaMikdash was being burnt, the Kohanim took the keys of the Beis HaMikdash and said, we're no longer worthy. And they took the keys and threw it in the air. And a giant hand came and took those keys. And he said, and now when the Beis HaMikdash of Lithuania was destroyed, a giant hand came down from Shemayim and took the key to the yeshiva because there's no longer any need for him. Wow. Okay. Shkoyach, guys. Next week, Rav Cook.